Are you ready to begin?
Yes, I'm all set here.
Any program about science or scientists today is almost bound to focus on space.
Hey, Houston, the Challenger has landed.
Houston Station, we are ready for the event. Thank you.
Welcome to the Space Boffins podcast with Richard Hollingham and Sue Nelson. And if life on Earth is getting you down, we'll be hearing from the astronaut who plans a move to Mars.
We'll also be tackling that cloud of litter surrounding the Earth with our live guest Lucy Rogers.
And I'll be talking to the head of the Kennedy Space Center.
We need to become what a spaceport should be, with commercial operations, government operations, cargo operations, crew operations, with flights going horizontal takeoff just to fly parabolic arcs to space with tourists and crews to orbit.
More from Robert Cabana later. In October 2008, a British-born computer games entrepreneur did what many space boffins would love if only they had the cash. He bought a trip into space. The son of a NASA astronaut, Richard Garriott, trained at Star City, flew in Soyuz, and spent 11 days on board the International Space Station. And his experiences have just been released as the film Man on a Mission.
I will launch and become the first second-generation American astronaut. This entire year, I've been in Star City, just outside of Moscow, training.
This is the goal that I have really been working towards for 20 to 30 years.
Well, I went to see a special screening of the movie, which not only reveals Garriott to be much more than a space tourist, but also gives an unofficial insight into the dangers of being an astronaut. For instance, he had to have major surgery to be cleared for spaceflight, and at one point, there's smoke seen coming out of the Soyuz control panel. Well, now Richard Garriott has even grander ambitions for private enterprise in space and a colony on Mars. But before we got onto that, I asked him how he spent his time in orbit.
My father, who flew before me, clearly knew that being at the window was the most important thing to do with my time on orbit. And it wasn't until I'd been in orbit about 5 days that I had the following epiphany, I'll call it. Already, just looking out the window, it's like there's a fire hose of information about the surface of the Earth that pours into your mind. I mean, you learn about meteorology, about tectonic plate movement, about erosion by water and wind. But then finally, only after a few days, I saw a part of the Earth that I knew intimately. In this case, it was Houston, Dallas, Galveston, Austin, places I'd grown up on and driven in a car in my college days, you know, regularly. So I knew that part of the Earth and its scale instinctively. And I could see the entire rest of the Earth. And suddenly I realized I now know the true scale of the Earth by direct observation. And at that moment, I had truly a physical reaction. It was like in the movies when the camera will dolly back but zoom in to where the main character stays the same scale on the screen, but the hallway seems to collapse around them. So as I looked down at the Earth didn't change scale, but it felt like it collapsed around my visuals. Suddenly, it became absolutely finite and, in fact, pretty small. It was truly a physical, shocking reaction that stays with me today.
Now, you spent tens of millions of dollars on that trip. Where is it going now? Because you're a real advocate of I think you've said that there's the privatization of space, if you like, the movement away from the big space agencies, particularly the NASAs.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that the NASAs and ESAs and Roscosmoses have a role to play. Theirs is true exploration. Anywhere there is to go first, you know, it's kind of like tall ships crossing the Atlantic to the New World. You know, without a government to sponsor those voyages, no one will ever make those voyages. However, once you've made the voyage, like let's say NASA takes a mission to an asteroid, well, either asteroids are really valuable because they're made out of rare metals that we can push back to Earth, or they're not. And if they are, NASA should not be the one to exploit it. NASA's not in the business of mining. If there's something to be mined off asteroids, private sector should clearly do it. And NASA should move on and go to Mars or whatever's next. And so whether or not there's anything there of value, NASA should go once, you know, or a small number of times. And we've not done that with low Earth orbit. I mean, low Earth orbit is still dominated by the International Space Station, and the only access has been governmental vehicles. And a more fundamental question is there something to do in low Earth orbit that's valuable? There either is or there's not. If there's truly not, none of us should be going back. No governments nor private industry.
But you're suggesting there is.
I do believe there is. I absolutely believe there is. And for example, you know, I paid tens of millions to take my flight. but I earned ones of millions on my flight while looking for businesses to pay for my flight. Under the current governmental control, the cost is tens or more commonly hundreds of millions of dollars per astronaut to put somebody in space. And the time on orbit, because of the $100 billion we spent to put this space station up there, the cost to keep an experiment up there is so high that it's hard for me to imagine, as an investor, a business that would be profitable under those conditions. On the other hand, there's no excuse for spaceflight to be as expensive as it is. It is already dropping now with the slight privatization that's beginning to occur. The true potential is a 100-fold decrease in the cost of access to space. Business in space is what's going to pay for low Earth orbit and relatively near Earth exploration.
And this is people doing business in space, people working on things in space rather than just satellites.
That's absolutely correct. In fact, let me even skip out ahead and go, like, let me tell you my plan for Mars, just as a case study for how I think this will happen. The Bush era plan for going to Mars was a 30-year, $5 billion or so per year plan that, if it ran on time and on budget, would require, you know, a doubling of NASA's budget for 30 years. And it's probably going to be over budget, and it'll probably be too late. And so the probability of that being sustained politically for that period of time is zero. Instead, I think that any plan we have for space, no matter what country we're in, has to be decadal at most, because that's as long as you can politically or communally keep things going. So imagine a plan where the first decade is you send NASA to an asteroid. And if don't go back unless there's something there valued. If there is, private can handle it. Next, you go to an icy moon around Mars. Great, go find some life or something. Probably no commercial value there, but that's okay, because NASA's in the job of exploration. Their next stop will be Mars. But in the intervening 20 years, just like we had the X Prize, that was a $10 million prize for the first private vehicle to fly twice into space, imagine if NASA put a $1 billion prize up to, say, land something on Mars that captures oxygen and puts it in tanks. You'd probably get a lot of competitors, and you get a lot of oxygen stored on Mars. Now I have another $1 billion prize that was for somebody to make a greenhouse, a self-sufficient greenhouse sitting on the surface of Mars. You'd probably get a few competitors for $1 billion prize. Now let's have another $1 billion prize, which is to build some igloos, some radiation-hardened living spaces, et cetera, et cetera. For $5 or $10 billion of prizes, not investment, only prizes, which means you only pay if they're achieved, you can probably get all the infrastructure on Mars that you would need during this intervening 20 or 30 years, all done robotically, all done by private competition, all funded by NASA, all led by NASA's vision. But then once all that's there, NASA builds the missions to send people there one way. The people that go to Mars first ought to be settlers. And the reason why is to get people back off of Mars is every bit as getting them off of Earth, but worse because they're at another world. And it'll be a lot easier to send people there one way, and then, you know, maybe we'll start bringing people back 100 years from now, but don't worry about that. Send settlers there one way, and that's the way to get people to Mars fastest. And if you want to talk about something that sounds kind of bold and audacious, say that, by the way, we have this stair-step plan that ends up with people being on Mars, and by the way, they're settlers, not just put a flag in and come back, I think that would get people's attention.
Would you go?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's funny, now that I'm married, I have to pause when I say absolutely, because now I got to convince my wife to come too. But still, the answer is absolutely. I think that, and what's funny is, a lot of people always react with, oh, come on, nobody's going to go one way. And I go, oh yeah, let's prove this. And you poll any room of people. I don't care what their political lives are like, what their economic status is. You poll any group of 10 people, and at least one, usually half, of the people would say, yeah, I'd go. And don't forget, if even it's 1 out of 10, even if it's 1 out of 100, that's still billions of, or millions at least, of people, you know, across the globe who would be happy to volunteer for this task. So finding the astronauts to become settlers on Mars is obviously not a difficult thing to do.
Yeah, obviously. Richard Garriott, entrepreneur and space adventurer. So let's have a quick poll around the studio here. He reckoned 1 in 10 would go on a one-way trip to Mars. So Sue?
Well, it depends. If I was in my 20s, I would have gone, yeah. No commitments, no family. Well, obviously.
Okay, let's have an answer,
family.
Yes or no?
Now?
Yeah.
No.
Okay, Lucy?
If it was for settling and not just a, oh, you can go there for 5 years and then you're going to run out of everything, then yes, I'll go.
Okay, and engineer John through the glass.
He's not sure. Well, he's wavering. So, yeah,
that's
well, maybe
still higher
maybe
than the
there.
One in 10, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's,
maybe.
That's pretty... What was the film like?
It's very, very good, actually. I was expecting a bit of an ego trip from a millionaire space tourist. Actually, it's fascinating. You get a real unofficial insight into space and a real appreciation of what Richard Garriott has achieved.
I can imagine the unofficial, because what I liked about listening to him, it was how straightforward he was in the way he talked. He sounds like the sort of guy you'd want around a dinner table with you after quite a few glasses of wine as well.
He gets things done.
Yes.
He developed some of the first virtual video games, online video games. That's how he made his money. And he's putting it into ventures like this. It's so exciting.
You've met him, haven't you, Lucy?
I have. I was at the UK Space Conference, or BROP, the British Rocket Oral History Programme, and he was invited to come along and gave a talk. And at one stage, I ended up getting a lift in the back of a Land Rover with him. George Abbey was in the front. James McFarlane from Airborne Engineering was driving. And yes, I was cramped in the back with a whole load of camping gear and other stuff in the back with Richard Garriott. We were talking about wooden toilet seats on the International Space Station, because I'd read that there were wooden toilet seats. And he confirmed it.
Excellent, excellent.
Well, we'll put a link up to the film on our Facebook page.
Now, the Earth is surrounded by more than 300 million bits of space junk or debris, ranging from flecks of paint to chunks of rocket, all travelling at around 17,500 miles per hour. Not surprisingly, that can knock out satellites, spacecraft, or a hole in the International Space Station. No wonder it makes mission control twitchy.
And Flight Director Ron Spencer is indicating that the time of closest approach has come and gone. No impact with this unknown piece of space debris, which is of an unknown size. And he has told the flight control team to stand by.
Lots of unknowns there, Anosis. That was from last year when astronauts had to shut themselves in the Soyuz capsules docked to the station in case it was hit. Now, since then, we've had the UARS satellite falling to Earth, and more recently, the failed Phobos Grunt spacecraft, which instead of heading to Mars, ended up in the Pacific. And with us is Dr. Lucy Rogers. Apart from being an engineer and author of the wonderfully named It's Only Rocket Science, she's director of the engineering consultancy Space Safety Research Limited, whose aim is to make the world a safer place by reducing space debris. Lucy, we heard, you know, an examples of what the range in size that space junk can have, but what predominantly makes up the junk that's circling our planet?
Well, the larger pieces are mainly inactive satellites, so satellites that we put up many years ago that have finished their useful job, and now they're just circling. Either they're coming down slowly and will burn up in the atmosphere, hopefully, or if we've put them out further into the geostationary orbit, once they're finished, hopefully we've managed to push them out into a graveyard orbit.
What's the greatest risk at the moment?
Well, it's not things coming down and hitting us on the head, although when UARS and Phobos Grunt came down, there was a, oh no, do we want to wear tin hats? That isn't actually the greatest risk. The worst thing that could happen is that if the wrong constellation of satellites got hit by space debris, we could be without power, without water, without communications within half a day all over the Earth. Worst case scenario, highly unlikely, but it could happen.
That's the scary bit, actually. As soon as you mentioned communications, I could feel a palpable sort of, you know, as people who are obsessed with going on their phones or their iPad or their computers. Is that scenario really likely to happen, though? Because you do hear from, obviously, the organisations that put satellites up in orbit. They know where the satellites are, what orbits they are in. And let's face it, even space is a very big place, but even the sort of our neighbourhood, there's still quite a lot of room there.
Well, there was, but the orbits that are particularly valuable, in as much as we can go around and map the Earth from them or use them for communication, they are getting more and more full up. And it only takes something the size of a cherry going at 17,500 miles an hour to hit your satellite, and that's the equivalent of a hand grenade going off next to it. And then you've got all those little pieces, they're going around at 17,500 miles an hour. If they then hit another satellite, you've got a cascade effect that's really going to be bad.
Which sort of is what happened when the Chinese demonstrated their anti-satellite, whatever it was, that weapon that they blasted one of their satellites out and created so many other pieces of debris there. Apart from that approach, sort of getting rid of it, there's quite a lot of technologies around, aren't there, in terms of ideas, in terms of how you remove the amount of debris. Take me through sort of what you would say are the sort of the most feasible ones.
Well, first off, we've now got mitigation guidelines so that when we put a satellite up, we have to make sure that it will come back down. If it's in low Earth orbit, it will come back down within 25 years. If it's in the geostationary, it will go out towards a graveyard orbit and get out of the way. So now that we don't just leave stuff in the way, we actually have to make sure that it's going to get out of the way. For the stuff that we no longer have control of, we can use ground-based lasers. Now, these are all still in the feasibility stage. These haven't been tested. But you can use ground-based lasers to move some of the larger but lighter things, so maybe a lens cap that we've taken off of a camera.
To disintegrate it, effectively?
No, sorry. You can slow it down. So you just use the pressure of the light from the laser, and as you push it, if you push it when it's coming towards you, it will slow it down slightly. As it slows down, it gets into a lower orbit. The lower orbit it's in, the more atmosphere it will go through.
And then it will burn up in the atmosphere.
And then it will burn up in the atmosphere and come down. So that's one way. The other major way of getting some of the larger satellites is probably tethers. This is where you go and attach something to your satellite and actually drop a very long cable down from it.
Sort of lasso it.
No, you've got hold of the satellite, you drop this 2-kilometre cable down, and then you put a current through the cable. So as you're going through the Earth's magnetic field, you're using something that we may have learnt in physics, the Fleming's
EMF.
Right hand.
Is this EMF?
Yeah,
One of these hand rules.
Yeah.
And so it provides movement. So you've got electric current, you've got a magnetic field, and that will produce movement, and that will bring it down. But again, that's only a few have been tested, but none of them been correct yet.
What about some sort of garbage truck in space? I imagine that sort of, I don't know, what was the James Bond film where they had this spacecraft that ate the other spacecraft, like a sort of big snappy thing?
So a huge recycling truck in space.
Could you do that? Is that feasible?
Space tugs are practically
feasible.
See,
you've got a name, Space Tugs.
Yeah, Space Tugs.
They
go out.
So, it's not so bad.
It's the RAC for outer space. It's possible, yes. In the early days of the space shuttle, the astronauts went out and actually collected a couple of failed satellites and brought them back down. Unfortunately, it's just not economically viable at the moment.
Now, you attended something called Singularity University, and I must admit, the first time I heard that, I thought, oh, she's made that up. It seems to want to use technology to solve humanity's challenge. Going there, was that what gave you the impetus to sort of take on the sort of save the planet role with space debris?
Well, it's the whole idea of Singularity University is to use the exponential technologies, so the technologies that are growing rapidly. Computing, Moore's Law is the obvious example, where the memory is doubling every couple of years. So we were taught all about the exponential technologies, and then we were also taught about all the world's problems, and we were tasked, as our projects and in our lives, to positively affect the lives of 1 billion people within 10 years. Now, there were people there working on health, there were people there working on poverty, there were people working on energy. And I thought, well, I could try and work on some of these, but my heart is really in space. What can I do that's in space? And when I wrote my book, I found out about space debris and the problem that it is, and I knew that it was just going to get worse. It won't get any better on its own. So that's how the project started.
And in fact, there was a report last year, a few months ago, by the American National Research Council that suggested that the world had reached a tipping point with space. But do you believe that, or do you think it was just getting attention, bringing attention to the problem?
I've heard various opinions. Some of the polar orbits, so as I said, some of the orbits where we go out and map the Earth, we go in the same orbit, and most of these go over the poles. Those are getting very congested. Whether we've actually reached this tipping point, not too sure, but I don't think it will take long. I think within the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to start seeing major satellites having collisions.
So what is there then to stop countries actually putting a concerted effort into solving the problem?
Technologically, I believe we can do it. There isn't the money for private industry to do it yet, because you can say, I've got this great gadget, we'll go up and clean up space, and everyone will say, that's nice. but I'm not paying for it. So why will people pay for it? But there's also a huge political issue involved. If you limit how people... If I have a laser on the ground that can bring down a dead satellite, I've got a laser on the ground that can bring down a live satellite. That's not going to be trusted too easily.
Will it need a few more collisions before something's done? Will it need some power outages, some communication failures, those types of things?
I'm hoping not. Hopefully,
but you suspect so.
Well, if we start working on the technologies now, when those things start happening in 5 to 10 years, we're actually going to have a really good method of starting to get them down to work on this. I mean, the Secretary of State for the USA, Secretary Clinton, just gave a press release recently for the International Code of Conduct for Outer Space Activities, saying we really must work on space debris. We must, as an international collaboration, we need to work on this. So people know about it.
And you want to set up a trade organisation as well?
Indeed. From my work that I did over the summer at Singularity University, I saw that not many people were working together on this. There was a lot of, yes, we'll mitigate, so we'll make sure we're not going to make any more in the future, but will the Russian government work with the US government, work with the Chinese government, when actually it's all the smaller companies and the private industries who are going to be using it in the future and making these developments? So my idea is hopefully to set up some form of trade association for all the stakeholders involved in space debris. So the satellite operators, the insurers, the people making the equipment, so that they all talk together, know what's actually is required, and can maybe fund each other. And so money isn't spent reinventing the wheel time and again by each country developing different things, but everyone working together.
Thank you, Lucy Rogers.
Well, no Space Boffins podcast would be complete without a space launch. And there's nowhere in the world better associated with launches than Cape Canaveral. Here's one of the first.
All right, lift off and the clock is started. Yes, sir, reading you loud and clear. This is Freedom 7. The fuel is go, 1.2G. Cabin at 14 PSI. Oxygen is go.
The excitement there. The launch of Alan Shepard's Mercury mission in 1961. Well, since then, Cape Canaveral, later the Kennedy Space Center, has seen the launches of Gemini, Apollo, Skylab and the shuttle. So now what? As the shuttles are packed away into museums, how is Kennedy adapting to the new era? Well, I've been speaking to the director of the center and astronaut on 4 shuttle missions, Robert Cabana.
There are significant preparations for the future. The North Pad, Pad 39B, has been totally cleared of all shuttle infrastructure and has been set up for our future launch capability, making it a clean pad concept where the support structure rolls out with the rocket and interfaces with the pad, and we can launch not just a government large rocket, but commercial rockets from that pad also. We're testing the Orion multipurpose crew vehicle. Hardware is actually arriving at the Kennedy Space Center now for the first test vehicle to fly. So great preparations are being made.
And is Orion the future? Is that going to be the first launch vehicle for humans back into space from the United States?
Not if we do things correctly. If we do things correctly, we will have a commercial capability to the International Space Station prior to that. We currently have Space Act agreements with 4 commercial companies that are paid and some unfunded Space Act agreements. In the end, one of them will be successful, and NASA will pay to utilize that vehicle to fly to the space station. The Orion vehicle is designed for exploration beyond low Earth orbit to allow us to go to near-Earth objects, asteroids, to the moon, to Mars, to Lagrange points. And the technology that goes into a vehicle that has to stay in space for those periods of time is different from that technology required just to go to low Earth orbit. Similar, they may look similar in some ways, but it has to be much more reliable, more complex systems.
Is that how you see it dividing up, so that private companies will take up the slack with delivering astronauts to low Earth orbit to the International Space Station, and NASA will develop the bigger technologies that are needed to take humans beyond the Earth?
Absolutely. We've been going back and forth to low Earth orbit for 50 years now, and I think that we should be able to define the requirements well enough that a commercial company could build a vehicle to do that. NASA needs to focus on the really hard stuff, the exploration, the stuff that's too difficult, is too expensive for a commercial company to bear.
And have you got a goal? It seems a little vague from outsider perspective. It was Mars, and you're talking about Moon, asteroids, Lagrange points. Where's the goal?
Well, we definitely have a goal. The ultimate goal is to get to Mars. That has been our goal all along. We've been given the goal by the president to be able to fly to a near-Earth object, an asteroid, by 2025, and to be in the vicinity of Mars by 2030. So our goal is to develop an evolvable spacecraft and vehicle that meets our commitments, that can evolve to what we need for exploration to go to Mars in the 2030 timeframe.
And what about for you? You see, in the end of the space shuttle, a vehicle you're obviously very close to. Can you turn that corner and think, right, we've got a goal, we're going for this now, and motivate your staff that that's what we're doing now, that the shuttle is over and we're now looking at this instead?
My goal is to truly make the Kennedy Space Center a multi-user spaceport. We need to become what a spaceport should be, with commercial operations, government operations, cargo operations, crew operations, with flights going horizontal takeoff just to fly parabolic arcs to space with tourists and crews to orbit. So yeah, I think that's a very positive goal, and the team is definitely on board to try and make that happen.
Director of the Kennedy Space Center, Robert Cabana. I think it's interesting that he picked up on the same themes as Richard Garriott, and there seems to be a feeling that we're entering a new phase of space travel. Do you think that's the case, Lucy, that there's a kind of privatisation, if you like, of space?
There's an awful lot of excitement out there, and the private companies trying to do their bit, hopefully just getting there, inching their way forward.
And you've worked as an engineer on rockets, haven't you, for space tourism. Do you think this is, you know, a definite way to go forward?
It's definitely an exciting way to go forward. Yes, I think the commercial payoffs are definitely there. We have a thriving UK space industry working on all sorts of things for space, so it's definitely an exciting time.
If you had the money, would you do... We had Stephen Attenborough from Virgin Galactic, and he was a brilliant, brilliant speaker, and I really enjoyed interviewing him with Richard for that podcast. And he described it in such detail, which I'd never actually heard before. And I couldn't fail to understand how anybody would not want to do that sort of flight. If you had the 127,000, I'm assuming if you're prepared to go to Mars, this would just be, oh, no problem.
I'd rather do an orbital or rather go to the moon for a holiday. Suborbital for 8 minutes or so.
She's in it for the long haul, isn't she? I can tell this.
I agree, because, I mean, I'm not mad about it. I'm not fussed about going into space. I'm really not. I love space, and I love all about it. I really don't. It's scary. Space is scary. So, I don't want to. But if I did, I wouldn't want to pay however many tens of thousands just to go up and back again. I had a really bumpy flight from Amsterdam to Luton the other day, and that was bad enough for me. If I went into space, I'd want the whole orbital experience. Mm. I'd want to do what Richard Garriott did, 11 days in space, yeah, looking down at the Earth, appreciating that, and just sitting maybe in the International Space Station, that cupola, and just looking out of the window, staring down at the Earth. And I could cope with that.
That's as far as you'd go, is it?
Yeah.
This is from the man who's been to Antarctica twice. I find it quite interesting that he finds going into space scarier than, you know, losing a few fingers. But there you go.
And incidentally, you can hear that interview with Virgin Galactic. It's on our Audio Boo page. And that's the Space Boffins podcast. We're an independent podcast produced by Boffin Media and supported by the UK Space Agency and the Atrium Space Insurance Consortium.
You can follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. And if you want to follow Lucy on Twitter, she's at Dr. Lucy Rogers. Thanks again, Lucy. If you like the podcast, do please spread the word. Next time, we'll be catching up with a lead scientist on the Messenger mission as it nears its first anniversary at Mercury. For now, though, thanks for listening.